This is a podcast from The Times.
The Bugle, audio newspaper for a visual world.
Hello, Buglers, and welcome to issue 105 of The Bugle, back after last week's unscheduled break, the audio newspaper that is, without question, the greatest cultural achievement in human history. Too much? Okay, what are the top 10 cultural achievements in the universe? Still too much? Okay, what are the top 100 cultural achievements of my professional career? This is the first tricontinental Bugle with me, Andy Zaltzman, here in early springtime London. In New York City, under 300 metres of snow, it's Corporal Chuckles himself, John Oliver. And now in Australia, in 35 degrees summer heat, it's Tom the producer. Three continents, three time zones, three climates.
Unbelievable, Andy, that the Bugle history has come to this. It's spectacular. I am back.
History.
I'm back. Hello, Andy. Hello, Buglers. Hello, Tom! Sorry for missing last week's Bugle, but I was out in LA both filming Andy and trying to convince Michael Bay to make Dick Pants one of the new Transformers in his next movie. It doesn't even have to be a Transformers movie, Andy. I just want Dick Pants to be a Transformer in it. Just to test if that character can take down one of the most profitable directors on the planet. But the best thing about LA this time, Andy, was the temperature. It was extremely warm there, which made a welcome change, because it is once again snowing its icy balls off here today, Andy. I'm supposed to be flying to North Carolina in a few hours, and to be honest, I'm not sure my plane is going to be taking off. This is the kind of snow we're talking about here. It's the kind of snow that says F*** you to airplanes. F*** you, airplane. You go nowhere. Nowhere. Thanks very much for putting out an extra emergency Bugle without me, Andy. Not just being tempted to use samples of my voice to Frankenstein a new Bugle like they did with Tupac's voice for years after his death. But by which I mean they made new rap singles with Tupac's voice, not that they made new episodes of The Bugle with him. Maybe that's what you should have done instead, Andy. Use technology to mean that you could co-host The Bugle with Tupac Shakur. It would have been fascinating to hear what Pac made of your Queen Victoria joke.
Well, I think he was quite a big fan of it when he was alive. This is Bugle 105 for the week beginning Monday, the 1st of March 2010, which means it's the anniversary of the day in 1953 when Big Joseph Stalin had a fatal stroke. I can only imagine the rest of the Politburo sitting around just not really wanting to make a false move and just imitating him and wandering around with wonky faces for a few weeks until someone realised he had actually died. And, of course, little Freddie Chopin, 200 years old today, the piano whiz from Poland. And they marked it with a 171-hour concert.
What?
Yep, they went on what you might describe as a real Chopin spree. is this on?
Oh,
I mean, I could have taken that further, but I've chosen not to. And you all owe me a debt of gratitude. But there must have been some people in the crowd absolutely busting for a waz by the end of that. I mean, it's classical music. You have to behave. You can't just nip out for a piss. Of course, Chopin didn't want to be a pianist and composer. He wanted to be a daredevil motorcycle stuntman. But the motorcycle hadn't been invented back in early 19th century Poland. And his mummy didn't like little Chopin getting his trousers dirty. So he turned his attention to competitive belching. And most of his hit piano sonatas began, in fact, as belch renditions of classic Polish rugby songs. In fact, recently discovered documents in the Polish town of Wrzeszów suggest that Chopin may have been the first superstar musician to play his instrument with his mouth. It was a big outdoor sonata festival in Bavaria when he got completely monged off his little nut and collapsed halfway through his chart-topping mazurka in G minor. Smashed his teeth on his piano, the crowd went wild, so he then woke up, set fire to it and finished the gig by smashing his piano stool to pieces. And the rest, as they say, is rock and roll history.
So, Andy, you asked for credit for not taking it any further, and then you did just that.
Well, I just meant I didn't do any more puns. I didn't do any more Chopin-based puns.
Okay.
Well, I could have done that. I could have done that. Also, happy birthday to Nick Griffin, leader of the BNP, and professional half-wit, well, quarter-wit. He's 51 today. No happy returns. By way of total coincidence, it's National Pig Day in America. And this week's section in the bin is a commemorative supplement to mark London's bid for the 2018 Winter Olympics. Now, critics have claimed that a lack of mountains in the London area could put the bid at a disadvantage against its opponents, but the bid committee have been investigating either building a 3,800-metre-high mountain in reclaimed marshland in the Thames estuary, or buying some Pyrenees off the cash-strapped Spanish government, dismantling them, shipping them back to Britain, and reconstructing them over uninteresting parts of West London, such as Ruislip. The bid committee is formed by the former Prime Ministers, Margaret Thatcher and Tony Blair, Cassius Taylor, the 13-year-old boy who is 29th in line to the British throne, King Harald V of Norway. Why Norway? Well, he's 63rd in line to the British throne. Hang on, those f***ing Vikings are at it again. Sneaking in by the back door. No, they didn't sneak in by the back door, lost them. They pretty much smashed in through the front door. Willie's out. Also on the committee are British ice hockey legend, the late Archibald Stinchcombe. This is true. He was part of Great Britain's immortal gold medal winning team.
Immortal.
From the 1936 Winter Games in Garmisch.
They were immortal.
We won an ice hockey gold medal, John.
Oh, dear.
They can't take that away from us. Admittedly, as a nation, we've kind of forgotten about it, so we've taken it away from ourselves. But they can't take it away, whoever they are. Oh, it's been a long week. That's 2 weeks of bullshit I've got stored up there because you f***ed off last week, John.
So you're saying I brought it on myself?
You brought it on yourself and you brought it on everyone else.
Top story this week, I love 1982. Andy, the Falklands War between Britain and Argentina ended 28 years ago, and little four-year-old John Oliver at the time, who was too young to understand the historical complexities involved in his country's claim to a tiny set of islands thousands of miles away, little did that boy dare to dream that nearly 30 years later, his two nations might make moves to flare up at each other once again. But it looks like it's getting closer. Argentina still claims sovereignty over the Falkland Islands, which it calls Islas Malvinas, although, I have to say, it really doesn't help your claim on the islands when you can't even say their name properly. It's Falkland Islands, Argentina, or at least El Islas Falklandos, as you would probably arrogantly choose to mispronounce it.
Well, of course, this is a dispute between a Latin American country and a Western power. So, John, can you guess who got dragged in? Who dragged himself in kicking and declaiming?
Is it? I mean, I know who it is. And it's the man who fires himself out of a cannon every morning. It's Chavez.
That's right, the Bahuela from Venezuela, the South American mouthy pelican, Hugo Chavez. And can you guess whose side he was on, John?
Well, I mean, I'm taking a stab in the dark. I'm guessing it was South America.
Well, let's find out. Here's what he said on his weekly TV show.
Okay.
Busy guy doing some showbiz as well as running his country and telling everyone else how to run their countries. He said these words. He said, "Look, England, how long are you going to be in Las Malvinas? Queen of England, I'm talking to you." He called out the Queen, John.
Oh, wow.
He called out the Queen.
I bet she was being held back. You did not just drop the cue.
And he carried on, "The time for empires is over. Haven't you noticed?" Well, I think she probably had noticed, just she just doesn't get as many Christmas cards as she used to.
That's exactly it.
Or as many "please can you get the f*** out of our country" cards. And even if she hasn't noticed, John, she's over 80. Don't spoil her world, Chavez. She's old. She likes stability.
Yeah.
He continued, "Return the Malvinas to the Argentine people." Well, John, he needs to be realistic. We haven't even given the Elgin Marbles back to Greece.
Yeah.
The best Argentina can hope for is a replica of the Falklands to be housed in an angry museum in Buenos Aires.
Get in line, Argentina. Take a ticket and wait.
He described British control of the Falkland Islands as anti-historic and irrational, and asked why the English speak of democracy but still have a queen, before failing to add, "Oh, hang on, that is a bit hypocritical coming from me, who has just been accused by the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights of endangering democracy and intimidating opponents in a 319-page report detailing how I've used state power to suppress opposition and decimate the independence of the judiciary. Yeah, sorry about that. Oh, hang on, I'm Hugo Chavez. I'm not going to take a report like that on the chin without dribbling my hot jalapeno soup all over it first." And this is how he responded to the report, John.
Yep.
He described the commission as nefarious and a mafia, and said that the commission's Argentinian head was executive excrement, pure excrement.
Now, The situation between Argentina and Britain was already tense nearly three decades ago, when the only natural resources connected to the island seemed to be a peculiar amount of sheep. But imagine how tense it is now that it turns out there may well be a shit ton of oil under there. The estimate is that there may well be 60 billion barrels of oil around the Falkland Islands. And Britain has really hit the jackpot with this, Andy. Many people were mystified as to why we cared enough to fight a war over the Falklands all those years ago, but now we've been rewarded. It was like we bought an ugly painting that no one liked from a thrift store, held on to it for decades, then took it on to Antiques Roadshow, only to be told there was a Rembrandt hidden behind it, and we were now stinking rich. People laughed at the state of our empire, Andy, and who's laughing now? We're the new Saudi Arabia! We need to start building ludicrous buildings and start oppressing women a lot more.
The Argentinians, of course, you know, when oil gets involved, people get a bit overexcited. Yeah. And the Argentinians described the imminent arrival in Falklands waters of a British oil drilling platform as, quote, a unilateral act of aggression and as whipping up the spectre of war. Now, there's a classic knee-jerk political reactions, John. Every country has them. In Britain, we just bang on about Europe. In America, you lot invade somewhere with no long-term follow-up strategy. If you're Ahmadinejad, you whinge about Israel. If you're Chavez, you stick it to America or the nearest available equivalent. If you're Argentinian, you play the old Falklands card. It is all you've got. The problem is with the spectre of war. It's not a particularly big or scary spectre in this case, and it's going to need a hell of a lot of whipping up to make it haul its poxy little ghost arse out of bed, because not only are Britain's armed forces significantly smaller than they were in 1982, but the Argentinian military, well, it's just not as big as when the government was the Argentinian military. They've kind of downsized and just not wasting quite so much of their national resources on being a massive military force. Basically, all they've got left is a guy in a van that he painted in camouflage after his divorce, the Argentinian Olympic canoeing team as the Navy, and a classroom full of kids with paper aeroplanes. So I'm not sure it's quite going to kick off.
A British oil firm called Desire Petroleum currently hold the exploration rights to the Falklands area. And that is a great name for an oil firm, Andy. Desire Petroleum. Name your company after exactly how you feel about your product. I desire petroleum. I do hope I find some later today. Why not just call themselves Really Want Some Oil Inc? They're basically almost there anyway.
It sounds like it might be a perfume. Desire by petroleum.
That's true. Argentina has formally asked the United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon to bring the UK into talks over the sovereignty of the Falkland Islands. Oh, come on, Argentina. You're going to bring Ban into this, running to the moon as soon as you feel threatened. It's pathetic. Now, the beauty with this is that Britain really must be able to count on the US with this one, Andy. We supported them in their morally dubious war for oil. Time to call that favour in. But, oh, hold on. What's this? It turns out the Obama administration has absolutely no desire to get involved in this at all. It has declined to back Britain's claim that oil exploration near the islands is sanctioned by international law, saying the dispute is strictly a bilateral issue. What? What happened to shoulder to shoulder? All we're asking for is a tiny set of islands, not a region in the Middle East. Et tu, Obama. Et tu. If Bush was president, Buenos Aires would already have been carpet bombed by now. Bring him back, Andy. At least we knew where we stood with that guy. Castle news now, and a farmer in England has lost his fight with the courts to save a castle that he hid behind hay bales. That is a hell of an opening sentence, Andy. That is a story appetizer which really whets your appetite for some more details. What's that you say? A farmer hid an illegal castle behind some hay bales? You have my full, undivided attention. Apparently, Robert Fidler built a mock Tudor castle, hiding it during construction and for some time afterwards behind straw bales and a tarpaulin, hoping to get by the planning permission system by applying for a certificate of lawfulness, sometimes applicable if no one objects to a newly built property for 4 years after construction. He kept the castle secret from 2002, when it was finished, until 2006. I love this guy, Andy. He hid a castle. If anyone deserves to have a castle, it's someone who successfully hides it for years behind hay. He earned that castle, Andy. He didn't inherit it. He didn't win it in a battle. He built it, and more importantly, he hid it behind hay. Never has a man deserved a castle more.
But sadly, the legal system is not flexible enough to deal with this, because the judge ruled the house was not technically completed until he had stopped hiding it behind bales of hay and tarpaulins. Which I guess is a key part of the building process. I guess, you know, were he to try and sell that house, it would just look like a load of bales of hay. So technically that's not finished, and that's what the legal system says. And it's not flexible enough, because sure, he's ridden roughshod over the planning regulations, but any right-thinking British judge would think an Englishman's home is his castle. Yes, the paperwork's not even slightly in order, but hey, what the f***? That guy built a f***ing castle on his own and hid it for 4 years.
Exactly.
Fair play to the guy.
61-year-old farmer Robert built the luxury four-bedroom castle, complete with ramparts, turrets and a cannon over 2 years, then lived in it with wife and son. A cannon! He even built a cannon! Come on! Let the man have his castle! In his bad news, Reigate and Banstead Council ordered the castle's demolition on grounds that he'd erected it illegally. This is bullshit, Andy. In fact, man the battlements, Farmer Robert. Do not let them take this from you. Now, there was one thing that I wasn't sure about here, Andy. Did someone discover his illegal castle, or did he suddenly reveal it to his neighbours? Because I hope it was the latter. Well, I hope he tore down the hay bales and screamed, "Behold! The castle of Farmer Robert! Look on my battlements, ye mighty, and despair!" And I hope he was wearing a full suit of armour when he did it.
Well, I think he might have got around the planning regulations if he just pretended that he found it. Yeah. You know, I can't believe it. These hay bales have been here ever since I moved in.
That's true.
Who would have thought it?
That's a good point. The only thing he's missing at the moment seems to be a moat. And I would encourage him not to compromise on his dream at the last moment. Get a moat. Farmer Robert, get a drawbridge and get a portcullis. You've come this far. You can't argue that a moat seems a bit excessive when you've built a secret castle. Don't go weak on me now. Just say the word and I will follow you into battle with Reigate and Banstead Council's planning department.
But also, in his defence, you know, who lives in Windsor Castle? The Queen.
Yes.
Where are the planning documents for that? I haven't seen him. The saying, an Englishman's home is his castle, would be legally enforceable, but it is sadly superseded by the less-known saying, if an Englishman builds a castle without doing the right paperwork, he can go f*** himself. There have been other well-known sayings that have been disproved. A stitch in time saves nine, for example. That was disproved when a bus driver in 1973 was stitching up a hole in his trousers before it got too big whilst driving his bus and ploughed into a bus stop, on which occasion the stitch in time killed nine and severely injured 31 others. Also, the saying, all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy. Well, if that's so, how come 24 is into its eighth series? Not a lot of play in that successful franchise. Maybe all work and no play makes Jack a slightly repetitive and increasingly implausible and formulaic boy, but dull, not quite yet. And also in the saying, among the blind, the one-eyed man is king. That's a misprint dating back to the days of Alexander the Great's daddy, Philip of Macedon, who was king and had one eye. So it should be among the Macedonians, the one-eyed man was king. Also, an apple a day keeps the doctor away. That's only true if consumed in conjunction with other food and drinks as well. That's absolutely key. And also, least said, soonest mended. That's, my great-great-uncle Balthazar disproved that one. He wouldn't tell the doctor what was wrong with him, and he died. Bugle feature section now, and Australia. And this is to commemorate Tom's arrival in Australia. Well, he's just emigrated with his wife and daughter, and therefore can't be heard on this week's Bugle because we haven't quite worked out how to get him on.
I'll just say this to you, Tom, that the population of Australia used to be 22,167,000. Now it is 22,167,003, with the glorious addition of Tom, Mrs. Tom, and the little version of Tom. This has been a great transfer for the Australians. So, I mean, maybe they'll send us Merv Hughes and David Campese in return.
God, that's quite rare for you to do a joke that none of your American listeners will understand, John. But amazingly, to coincide with Tom's arrival, I think the very next day after he'd landed there, the Australian Prime Minister, Kevin Rudd, warned that his country is now under a permanent and increased threat of militant attack.
Oh, Tom. Tom, what are you doing over there? You land there less than 24 hours later, they've raised the threat level. That can't be just coincidence. Has it got safer in Britain, Andy, since he left?
Oh, yeah. We haven't had any major terrorist attacks since he left.
Oh, Tom. Tom. I could only hope that the fact that you're now upside down just puts all the blood to your head and stops you from considering a major terrorist attack.
Incidentally, Kevin Rudd is the first ever world leader to be called Kevin that I've ever heard of.
Right.
And that's quite a big step for a country to take. I don't think America is prepared to take that yet. You know, would Abraham Lincoln have made it if he'd been called Kevin Lincoln? It just doesn't have the requisite authority. It's fine for a young nation like Australia, not for us.
In other Australian news, Australians are being urged to have a vindaloo against violence as a way to take a stand against racism directed at members of the Indian community. And I think this is a great idea, Andy, because I would argue that it is impossible to be racist to Indian people after you've tasted their food. It just can't be done. It's too delicious.
Yeah, but the vindaloo, of course, is famously hot.
It is
and
hot.
This was a huge success. 17,000 people at 400 restaurants took part, apparently, this week. And the majority rising up against the violent intolerance of the racists and doing so by going out to dinner and eating health-endangeringly spicy food. It is the only language the bigots understand, John. They're going to be sitting there thinking, well, if 17,000 people are prepared to eat those mouth-blisteringly hot curries and cop it digestively for the following 72 hours just to tell me I've been acting like a tool, well, I'm going to have to reconsider my Neanderthal socio-political views. That's the only way to get the message across these days.
I guess it would have been safer to have a Jalfrezi against violence, but you lose the alliteration and so much of the power of the idea.
Alliterative stuff in politics is very dangerous, John, because we know politicians are extravagantly mindful of negative PR bloopers, and apparently since this Vindaloo against violence scheme, Australian MPs have been beset by worries over the danger of eating dishes with potentially negative alliterative connotations, and sales of hot dogs have plummeted in the Parliament canteen due to fears they could be interpreted as hot dogs for Hitler. No one wants to be seen chowing down on a plate of meat pies for murdering pensioners or guzzling a glass of white wine against women. But understandably, modern Australia is a bit sensitive about racism these days, given the whole, I don't care if you were here first, it's our land now, find us keepers and all that. No, no, we found it. You can't find something if you were already on it. Tell you what, let's settle this once and for all with a nice friendly game of bang, bang, bang. I'm terribly sorry, I appear to have all but wiped you out. Tell you what, you can have this by way of an apology. What is it? I think it's a kind of perfume. It's called smallpox. You'll love it. Oh, it's not a perfume, silly me. It's a fatal disease that will ravage your population. Hey-ho, have a drink and forget about it. Business. They're all kicked off when Britain pitched up a couple of hundred years ago. I was in Australia about 3 years ago. I was staying in a hotel in Sydney and walked in the lobby of the hotel, and there was a little TV screen, and there was a conference there. And the company's name was on there saying staff from this company should go to this room. And the name of the company was Total Tools. I still think that's probably the funniest thing I've ever seen. Apart from a bit of graffiti in Rome, which is a very carefully drawn cartoon of Mickey Mouse with a big speech bubble saying, F*** off. Anyway, to commemorate the Australia section, we now have a prize Australia quiz. Two questions. Question one, which Australian legend did my wife once say that she thought I was whilst sleep-talking in the year 2002? Did she say, I'm sorry, I thought you were A, 1960s Australian Prime Minister Harold Holt, who famously retired from politics by disappearing in the sea? Ever since then, any Australian Prime Minister swimming in the sea have to wear armbands and be accompanied by a special body double covered in ketchup to act as a sacrificial decoy in the event of a shark attack. Was it B, Australian tennis legend and 24 time Grand Slam singles winner Margaret Court? Although, to be fair, I could understand that was during a phase when I used to wear a Margaret Court mask to bed. C, homemade helmet fan Ned Kelly, who famously at his smash hit 1880 execution, was forced to make and wear a pair of steel artificial breasts to make himself feel more ashamed of his crimes as he died. Or D, the actor and Neighbour star Ian Smith, most famous for his long-term role in the hit soap opera as Harold Bishop, for which he was nominated for no fewer than 15 Oscars for Best Actor, albeit that was in his own personal Oscar ceremony that he held in his garden shed on Oscar night every year for 16 years. 15 nominations. Only one win. Tough break. Question two. Which two of the following Australian place names do not actually exist? All of these are real apart from two. A. Cockwash. B. Chairman's Knob. C. Mount Buggery. D. Humpy Bong. E. Titty Bong. F. Pimpin' Budgie. G. Honky Tonk Badonkadonk. And H. Rudy Giuliani's Fantastic Trapeze Extravaganza.
It's a silly country.
That's what you've moved to, Tom. You brought it upon yourself. So the answers are C, Ned Kelly. My wife woke up and said to me, sorry, I thought you were Ned Kelly. And the answer, of course, to the second one was G and H, not the Honky Donk Badonky Donk and the Rudy Giuliani one. All the rest are real names. And that question could have gone on a lot longer. And the prize, if you got both right, is a free late 18th century conviction for low-level thievery and a place on a convict boat to the exciting new penal colony.
Your emails now, and there's a great email here from Matt to Tom on advice for Tom, the new Australian. He says, Dear Tom, or G'day Tom, I'll probably be how you would say it now.
Well, I think that's how it's pronounced. It's written dear, you actually pronounce it G'day.
Okay. Yeah. He says, in order to make an easy transition into Australian society, here are a few suggestions. One, lose the accent. Two, open up every conversation with a racist joke related to Muslims, the Lebanese, or the Aborigines with no detectable ironic racism. If the person you're talking to is offended, tell them they're un-Australian and to grow a sense of humour. Australians can take the piss out of everyone except themselves. Three, change your name to Neville, Barry, Shane, or Wayne. Four, attach as many Australian flags to your car as you can. Remember, the more Chinese-made flags attached to your Korean-made hatchback means you're more patriotic. Maybe top your flag ensemble off with a off we're full bumper sticker. Very wise. Five, be drunk all the time, although being Scottish, you'll have no problem with this one. Ouch. Six, buy a Chesty Bonds blue singlet, also known as a wife beater, and write the following message on the front. In Australia, we eat meat, drink beer, and speak English. Oh, God. This is the traditional shirt for weddings and funerals. Yours in oi, oi, oiness, Ken Dance Commander. There you go. This should help you just slide right in. Assimilate.
Actually, I've had a off with full bump sticker. I found it very useful. I just put it across my chest when walking down streets full of restaurants late at night to avoid the restaurant owners trying to talk us into taking a table. This email came in, brought us a very important story to our attention. It comes from Nick Piccolino in Cranston, Rhode Island, who simply writes, I will let the headline of this article speak for itself. And the headline of that article is, huge shark-filled aquarium in Dubai cracks open. safety officials described it, John, as a small crack in the tank which holds 10 million litres of water and 33,000 sea creatures. And I guess, you know, picking up on the theme from the Dubai stuff we did the other week, I guess the thing is, if you're going to build a f***ing stupid aquarium in a f***ing stupid building, and this is up in the mall which is underneath the Burj Khalifa Tower, something like that is inevitably going to happen,
yeah.
John.
Yeah.
Inevitably. You know, if you put sharks in a shopping centre, we've all seen films, John. We all know what happens. People get eaten by sharks. So do keep your emails flooding in to thebugle@timesonline.co.uk, or I have no reason to carry on living.
Sport now and Winter Olympics news. Andy, hosting the Winter Olympics is a great opportunity for any city. It's a chance for them to point to themselves on the world map and remind everyone where they actually are. But Vancouver has been having some real troubles, right from the opening ceremony when a column for the Olympic flame failed to rise, leaving Wayne Gretzky standing there looking understandably confused as to what his next move should be. Maybe he should set himself on fire and run around screaming the words Olympics. Luckily, he didn't do that. He just waited. But now there's even more controversy over the permanent Olympic flame, which has been fenced off from the public to such an extent that it looks like the flame is being held in an East German jail. Although that's actually very wise. Andy, everyone knows the Canadians cannot be trusted around an open flame. They lack the discipline not to hurt themselves with it. That's why they're only allowed left-handed scissors and pretend beer up there.
I guess Gretzky's slightly out of his comfort zone whenever he has to do something that doesn't involve hitting a puck with a hockey stick.
That is the problem. That's the key problem.
He's fine. He's really good. We're really good at that. Everything else, you know, just not. It doesn't come quite as naturally to him.
I tell you, one thing you cannot fault Canada for, though, is their choice of mascot. They're the first Olympic Games ever to have three mascots. And most importantly, one is a monster. It's a Sasquatch called Quatchy, who has dreams of it one day becoming a hockey goalie. And you know, this really should be encouraged, Andy. More monster mascots. For too long, too many Olympic hosts have chosen mascots that are just, you know, cuddly oranges or friendly pieces of pasta. Well, well, no more. Canada have raised the bar. All future hosts must follow Canada's lead and feature mascots that are monsters from local urban legends.
Well, apparently the London Olympics mascot is going to be Jack the Ripper.
Oh,
that's
nice.
taking it one step
perfect.
Further.
Not a monster, but certainly threatening. I appreciate that.
A nice cuddly sex criminal. But it's drawing to a close now, or if you watch the British coverage, the curling's nearly finished. Because that's basically all they've shown, just because we had a chance of a medal. But it's had it all, these Olympics. Personal triumphs against the odds, incredible feats of sporting skill and bravery. Loads of gravity. John, hell of a lot of gravity in the Winter Olympics. It's had tears, tantrums, technical glitches, PR bloopers, bickering about judges, equipment, weather and what constitutes corporate manslaughter. And the need, or otherwise, for quadruple jumps in ice skating. But above all, John, it's had snowboard cross and ski cross. Four people hurling themselves, A, down a mountain, and B, straight into each other. Now, either A or B in isolation is a bit much for me, but both at once, I have a new sport to follow. This is everything crown green bowling can't be, John. Because when you think of the Winter Olympics traditionally, you don't think of mid-air collisions. And that's all they've got. I saw two skiers smash into each other about 10 metres off the ground the other day. That is real sport. Famously, in the 2006 women's snowboard cross final, Lindsay Jacobellis tanked a certain gold medal by showboating over the final jump and falling flat on her bot. And her reaction at blowing her shot at sporting immortality was to say, "I was having fun. Snowboarding is fun. I was ahead. I wanted to share my enthusiasm with the crowd. I messed up. Oh, well, it happens." And by doing that, John, and by saying that, she grasped an even bigger slice of immortality, a 19th century attitude in a 21st century sport. Will a footballer in this summer's World Cup, John, did you hear that? This summer's World Cup.
Wow. God, that's good, isn't it?
Will any footballer the World Cup have the bare-knuckle balls to try to backheel a penalty kick in a semi-final shootout, miss, then slap his thigh and said, "Oh, well, that would have looked funky if it had gone in. Hey, lads? Why are you looking at me like that? Come on, backheel penalty, how cool would that be? Why are you all crying? I was just having a laugh. The crowd were egging me on. Oh, it's only a game. Who's for some keepy-uppies while the police try to put that riot out?" I can't see it happening, John.
The most disappointing gaffe in Vancouver has been the lack of snow. And I think this really shows that Canada should never be awarded another Olympics, Andy. It's for their own good. The 1976 Summer Olympics nearly bankrupted Montreal. Now Vancouver's in trouble. And the one thing you'd think you could trust Canada with is snow, and they can't even get that right. We need to host the Winter Olympics in the only place on Earth which has 100% guaranteed snow, Andy. Dubai. They've been stockpiling it in their indoor ski slopes for years. The rest of us can't be trusted. Dubai!
But what have we learned about the world from this? And what have we learned about Britain, more importantly? I guess we've learned that British women are the best in the world at lying on a train, flinging themselves down an icy tube head first. But they're not quite so good at lying on a train, flinging themselves down an icy tube feet first. Now, that's a key thing we've learned from these Olympics. Amy Williams, the skeleton bob rider, or slider, became the new golden girl of British winter sport. So everyone can now take down their posters of 79-year-old Jeanette Altweg, the 1952 figure skating champion. bit of controversy as well for the American team. Half-pipe snowboarder Scott Lago was sent home after dangling his bronze medal in front of, his dangler and asking women to kiss it.
Yeah,
that's what snowboarding brings to the Olympics,
that's
John.
That's the thing. If you let the snowboarders in, that's the kind of shit they're going to do. It's not act surprised. You wanted them there. You got them there. This is what happens.
Now, how has the Own the Podium scheme gone down in America, John?
What's that?
Well, it's been quite a big thing over here. The Canadian scheme, they call it the Own the Podium scheme, in which they attempt to maximise Canadian medals by basically sabotaging non-Canadian competitors.
What?
By restricting their access to practice facilities and the build-up to the games.
I didn't know that.
And also apparently doing things like leaving poisonous snakes in their baths, teasing them when they were trying to concentrate, and putting hot chili powder in their underwear. All in the name of sporting glory. Own the podium, a bit of a misunderstanding of the old Olympic motto. So that's it for this first Tricontinental Bugle. Admittedly, you won't have heard much of Tom in this alleged third continent, but that's where it's being put together. And then beamed back here, and then sent around the world to all the remaining 24 continents.
Isn't technology wasteable?
So just time for this week's forecast. Big story in Britain this week, as John, has been the alleged bullying by the Prime Minister.
Oh, yeah.
Gordon Brown, apparently. There was a book written by a journalist saying that he bullied his staff.
Or did he steal their lunch money?
I think so. There'll be more revelations coming out inevitably in the next week. And I guess what we want to know is, what will be these latest revelations? Will it be that he demanded protection money from his secretarial staff, that he called junior ministers rude names, impugning their bowel control abilities, or that he gave Chinese burns to visiting dignitaries? The Chinese burn is, I believe it's called the Indian burn in America, and it's known as the policeman's glove in Hungary. Now, it's a lovely little social relic of the good old communist days. I think it is going to be that he headbutted the Queen. He said, let me be king. Let me be king.
Wow. You headbutt the Queen, you uncork that Pandora's box, Andy. She will come at you crazy.
Well, that's it, Buglers. We'll be back again next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.
For the best in sport, comedy, science and books, go to timesonline.co.uk/podcasts.